Okay, thank you. Next is Neri Buxban.
Thank you. I want to react to a few things, not necessarily in any order of significance, but it strikes me as very important discussion. It strikes me as a case that almost everybody is right. So when you listen to every single comment here, you must say everybody is right, and maybe some are more right than others in different circumstances. It starts with, what is accounting? What accounting should convey, which is beyond the question of this board, but simply what accounting is. And I'm going to react to several topics, but the bottom line of my message is that I think assumptions, estimates, and judgments always been part of accounting to a certain extent. Yes, they are increasing, but they have been a significant portion of accounting. Loan loss reserves is a major, major assumption. Depreciation, whether you want to use double declining balance, sum of the digits, straight line, machine hours, or anything similar, has been a judgment. Lower of cost on net realizable value has been a judgment. And the list goes on. So the question, and I think Michael made the comment that the profession should rise to the challenge. I think if there's one profession that is seems to be the immediate candidate to rise to the challenge, is the auditors. You know, carpenters are not going to do it. Taxi drivers are not going to do it. They're probably going to be the auditors. So if you think that estimates and assumptions are important in this context, they're clearly relevant. And I will use another example just to put it somewhat in context or an analogy. And it helps me think through the process. Let's say that I stand in the midst of Central Park in mid-July, and I had a really good measurement tool to measure the temperature. And I know that it's 85 degrees. And then I find myself in the same environment 2 quarters later, at December 31st. And it's really, really cold, but measurement tools are no longer available because of some unique circumstances. All the thermometers are gone. So I said, the last time I was here, it was 85, must be 85. So should I close my financial statement with 85, or should I move to a level 3 measurement and tell you that it's really, really cold, my knees are shaking, and it must be something in the range of, and why? And why do I use this analogy? Because it's very vividly evident in the context of certain instruments, that if I'm a user and I'm getting, the instruments are traded, they're measured, it's very easy to measure, and we all feel comfortable with the value, and then the market dries up. What should we do? Should we revert to a different accounting method? Should we flip every quarter? Should we flip every couple of years when the economic environment is changing? It is a very difficult framework for users. So you can appreciate the challenges in getting to a measurement, but you can also appreciate the challenges in thinking about an accounting framework that will be highly dependent on only something that I can measure precisely. And that speaks to the need to start thinking about what accounting means. And what I would speak to what investors need, and I agree wholeheartedly with Charlie, that the disclosures will not provide a silver bullet, absolutely not. But will they provide you with something? Because, and we'll start with some divergence, but over time, things will converge. I think the fact that you cannot precisely measure everything or gets to consistency does not mean that you should not have judgment. From an investor standpoint, and spending a lot of time with financial statements, what I've learned that consistency is in many respects illusory. And we're learning about it every time you have a financial debacle or anything, and then you look at the accounting rules and you see how being applied, and because of estimates. The question is, how low can you go with respect to the level of estimates? So given that, my bottom line, it must rely on a broader system that will think about, you know, accounting standards, and to Lynn's point, whether the accounting standards or something else will prescribe what type of documentation judgment should take shape, absolutely. Should there be some framework to say what's framework to audit those judgments? It's not the same as confirming cash. It's a different process. Should it, and that's probably where the board can play some sort of a role in my mind. And the question is, you know, maybe you don't need a level one, level two auditing, but there's a clear framework to that you audit judgments somewhat differently than you audit cash. It's also close to the level of talent. If you need to audit something that's more complex, by definition, you need, you know, if you're going to look and trying to decipher how NASA is assembling, you know, some complex vehicle, you need somebody with equal knowledge of complexity. So, if those estimates and assumptions are highly complex, I think the accounting firm should match skill those talents. And it's not that they don't do it today. It just seems evident that to the extent that this exists, there's some elements of talent, and if for anything, even if the talent exists, should speak to a notion of validation. Then the third layer in this discussion would be the notion of compliance. And this goes to Barbara's comment. I think when people are speeding, you have two ways to deal with this. One is close the roads, and then there's no speeding. Or two, manage speeding and make sure that you have the right attitude to compliance. So if you do have the framework, I think you may have greater opportunity to do enforcement, compliance, and uproot those potential bad apples. And now if you say that maybe Neri is overly naive, that's never going to work, then you revert to point two. And point two may mean that all you do is financial reporting is something different than judgment, something that's solely non-judgmental. And then you have to rethink what financial reporting is all about. So I think you've got a tapestry of issues, some of which belong with the board, but some of which belongs with a coordinated effort between perhaps market regulators or the board itself, as well as the FASB. So I think it's very difficult to solve in isolation.
Yeah, I certainly take away from your comments the summary you made of a tapestry of issues, as you pointed out. But I also took away, as I listened to you, it sounded again like preparer documentation requirements was something that would be important in this, because when you're making these judgments in Central Park, how you got to whatever that temperature was with the unobservable inputs, if auditors are going to audit something, they need a lot clearer preparer documentation of how they got there, and that's an important takeaway. As well as the fact that the person who's going to audit that documentation needs to have more experience. So thank you very much for those comments.
Doug Carmichael.
It is important for the PCAOB to get out ahead of the game in the standard setting, and I think the key area is for revenue. Wayne did an excellent job of explaining the difficulties are going to be faced with respect to good faith judgments. When you add to that Barbara's very legitimate concern on bad faith judgments, you begin to appreciate the dimensions of the problem. The FASB, for one reason or another, has concluded that it really cannot consider in setting accounting standards management's ability or propensity to distort the results. Their standard setting, they've concluded, I believe, has to be neutral in that regard. But in this particular area, in the revenue area, it is extremely important to recognize that ability and propensity. There's a substantial amount of empirical research. And in the accounting academic world, it's generally referred to as conservatism, but I caution you not to use that label, because that doesn't mean the kind of old-style conservatism that the FASB has rejected, to anticipate all losses and defer all gains, but one that recognizes that management has the ability and propensity to overstate, and there is a much greater overstatement risk for revenue, and that investor reaction to that overstatement has more serious consequences. In other words, the investor response to an overstatement of earnings has much more consequence than the investor response to understatement. So the overstatement risk is dramatically greater, and the empirical research does demonstrate that. The fraud risk is greatest in the revenue area. The past frauds tell us, among other things, that they usually start with overly aggressive accounting, that management doesn't start off saying, well, I'm going to have the goal of fraudulently overstating my earnings. It's a temporary effort to deal with the problem, and when things get better, the aggressiveness will be stopped. And if the aggressiveness continues, things don't get better, and it progresses to outright fraud. A lot of that fraud has involved not just fictitious earnings, but a substantial portion of it has been upfronting the revenue, premature recognition of revenue. Fictitious revenue is a problem too, but premature recognition is a significant problem. So I think there is a dramatic need for a new auditing standard devoted to how you audit revenue. And Marty, your questions on that, I would answer with all of the above, but I think there are some very important points. In addition to developing and directing auditors to use more effective procedures in this area, recognizing management's ability and propensity to overstate revenue, that's been done. The recognition of that is there in the auditing standards now, but the response is not there in the auditing standards now. In other words, auditors are advised that they should presume there's a fraud risk for revenue, but when you compare that to the amount of direction they're given on how to deal with that, the direction is fairly paltry. As you were saying, Marty, documentation is extremely important. And I think in this area, it is going to be necessary to recognize what I think has always been true, that is that the auditing standards need to start where the accounting standards stop. And it would be nice if the accounting standards specified in more detail the documentation that management needs to support its revenue measurement. If the accounting standards don't provide enough, or wherever the accounting standards stop, that's where the auditing guidance needs to begin. The auditing standards can specify what documentation the auditor needs to see from management in order to give a clean opinion. That's the province of the auditing standards. Wherever the FASB concludes they'll stop in telling people what documentation is needed, that's where the auditing standards should start. Auditing is not supposed to be a best efforts exercise. As one former chairman of the Auditing Standards Committee was fond of reminding everybody, not every client deserves a clean opinion. And it's in the cases I've looked at, it's too often the case that auditors, it's not that they failed to recognize the problem, but when they faced the problem, concluded, well, they had done the best they could at giving the evidence that was available in the circumstances, and therefore they give a clean opinion, rather than recognizing that the best information available in the circumstances to anybody wasn't enough to support a clean opinion, and it was necessary in that circumstance to disclaim an opinion. And I think that needs to be emphasized in the new auditing standard on revenue recognition. Once you've specified the documentation the auditor needs to see to reach a judgment on whether management has met the requirements for revenue recognition, if those requirements haven't been met, the auditor needs to not express an opinion on the financial statements, and then that needs to be dealt with by other regulatory authorities. But to reiterate, the current approach of auditing being a best efforts exercise, particularly in this revenue recognition area, has to be dealt with very directly in the standards.
Thanks, Doug. You made a lot of good points, and but maybe the biggest one I take away, and I think worth repeating, is the auditing standards already state that the auditor should presume that there's a risk of material misstatement due to fraud with respect to revenue recognition. And that's in the environment where we have hundreds of rules about how revenue should be recognized, rules specific to each industry, for instance. And so, as Wayne pointed out, there's a lot of challenges now to judgments going into that revenue recognition. And as Barbara indicated, unfortunately, some companies will reach to the most biased, reasonable decision they could, judgment they can get to. And so, therefore, that risk, the fraud risk presumption that's there now in a rules-based environment, we have to consider that in terms of, well, what does that mean now in in this highly judgments-based environment in terms of the increased risk due to fraud in revenue recognition. So I appreciate that point and that concern.
And just to follow up, Doug, in terms of the call for guidance on revenue, one of the things that the staff has heard is we do have guidance in 316 on fraud and some of the new risk standards that talk about confirming terms of site agreements, and some have suggested the need for perhaps a practice alert that pulls that all together for this new revenue standard. And I just wanted to clarify, were your remarks related to the fraud aspect of revenue or the judgment aspect that's going to be required in this new principles-based standard, or both?
Both. I don't really think you can separate them. The increased use of judgment in the area will create an increased risk to an already serious risk of overstatement in the revenue area. And I think if you are going to get out ahead of the game, this is the area you should target.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
Thank you. Just a few comments on this. I do think that absolutely there's going to be more pressure on our people, on the auditors, and that staffing model needs to be looked at very closely. I really liked those comments about where the accounting stops, the auditing standards have to begin, and it's not a best efforts thing. I think that really resonates. But I'd like to give one example of that. As I was looking through the international standards in this new world of principles-based versus rules, at least on 20 different occasions it talks about the pass, is what I would call it, of having to do something, whether it be evaluation or getting an actuarial report if there is undue cost or effort involved. At least on 20 different instances, that's there, and hopefully the FASB, as they move forward on these new standards that are coming out, that can be avoided, because I think it is a pass. If it ends up being a pass in the accounting standards, the auditing standards are going to have to pick up on that, and you find this in the fair value model. Investments, property, plant, and equipment, intangibles, all throughout these standards, you see that sort of language. And then I just wanted to comment on Neri's comment. I mean, I think that the auditors will ultimately step up to the challenge. I have that kind of faith in them. However, I at the same time, it's important to recognize that that's not where it begins. It begins with the CFO and the controller and the company, and the independence involved in this doesn't allow the auditor to make the kind of judgments that the PCOB is not regulating within the company. And so anyway, thank you.
Jim Schnur.
A couple of observations. One, I agree with Neri's point that from an accounting profession standpoint, judgment is not a new thing. I mean, whether it be accounting or auditing judgments, we have to make them every day. The one thing that I think we need to focus on here a little bit is there are two types of judgments. There are accounting judgments and there are auditing judgments. When I look at the 4010 report and I look at the experience with my own firm, I think those comments are primarily auditing judgments. I'm not aware of a lot of situations where the findings that the PCOB inspection staff had has led to a restatement. So there isn't a question about the accounting judgments. It's the sufficiency and competency of the audit evidence that the audit firm had with respect to the audit judgment. So, my question is, should we be focusing on standards or practice aids around what constitutes sufficient and competent audit evidence with respect to these different judgments? So Dan talked yesterday about the fact that CIFRA report had the judgment framework for accounting judgments, and that the and that Wayne and Jim Croker's staff had been following that. But I think the issue goes to audit judgments. That were, and so I think we need to be clear about not confusing the two when we look at this. You know, one of the things that I think we should look at, you know, with respect to, for example, fair value estimates is, are there more efficient ways to gather audit evidence? So Marty talked about pricing services. Well, you know, should there be a mechanism where there's a SAS 70 report around a pricing service so that the, you know, the individual companies and the firms don't have to go in and effectively audit how the pricing services come up with their estimates of, you know, of value associated with a particular security. One other point is I do take exception to Barbara's comment that auditors have trouble challenging judgments and do a poor job of that. I can tell you that there are, on a daily basis, we, and I'm sure my counterparts in each of the firms, go and tell clients that the approach they're using with respect to an accounting a judgment or the estimate they have was not appropriate. But we're certainly not perfect. But I don't think we have trouble making those decisions and communicating them, whether it be to management or to the audit committee.
Barbara, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, I was referring in part to the presentation we heard yesterday, which if you look at, you know, in the report on the problems of auditing and the financial crisis, if you look at the things that they document where they saw shortcomings in the auditors, most of them related to this issue of failing to challenge or adequately test evaluations, assessments, judgments. And that's my point. Not that auditors never do it or never do it effectively, and don't, but that it is, it struck me in reading that, that it is one of the hardest things that auditors have to do, and we're designing a system that asks them to do more of it. And, you know, I would get, I mean, I would just suggest that there may be lots and lots of audits where it works just fine. That, my basic point was that we're designing a system that may work fine in many cases and then be disastrous in those cases where investors need that system the most.
Thanks, Barbara. Dan?
I just asked Jim a question before we go on. Maybe we're talking past each other a little on this auditing judgment framework. And first, I do understand what you're saying about a difference between auditing judgments and accounting judgments. But it seems to me if we're going to talk about a judgment framework with respect to whether there's sufficient evidence has been gathered in auditing to support a particular assertion, either one of two things would happen. It would have to be at an extremely general level. I mean, it would ask questions like, what's the nature of the evidence I've gathered so far? How objective is it? To what extent do I have contrary evidence? What other steps could I take to gather more evidence? I'm not sure that I see that a framework like that that we might issue would really be of much benefit to people. On the other hand, what you might mean is a judgment framework that looked at specific auditing problems. How do I exercise judgment in auditing a level 3 fair value determination? And if we were to go down that road, it seems to me you're really asking us to write the auditing program for you, and I'm not sure that that's particularly desirable. So if there's something else that's being discussed when we talk about an auditing judgment framework, at least at the moment, I don't really understand what it would be.
Well, Dan, I think some of it does go to it may be specific to the nature of the item that's under audit, right? I mean, we talk about fair value. there's been a lot of dialogue between the staff and the profession about how to interpret the existing auditing standards with respect to, you know, what's the what level of audit documentation needs to be gathered with respect to an individual item. So, you know, there's there need to be clarification of what do the words mean. That would be an example. Now, you know, can you put a framework around it? I don't know. That was one of my questions around is there need to be more detailed guidance around what, you know, what constitutes sufficient and competent audit evidence? Because, as I said, when I look at the report, and I know my own experience, it looks like that's where there's a disconnect, not necessarily that the accounting judgments that a company's made and then the auditors have looked at and concurred with is wrong.
Okay, thanks Jim and Dan. Next, Brian Croteau.
Thanks. I was actually going to raise a question to bring out some of this evidence discussion, which has actually now come out, but so I won't raise that question, but instead I would at least just make the point that I don't think we should forget that companies certainly have a responsibility from a books and records perspective and an internal control perspective to be thinking about what they need for documentation and the controls that they need to have in place. And so as we think about the auditing standards picking up where the accounting standards leave off, I think that's just something we should keep in mind as well, and that should be a source for the auditor to be considering. The only point I'll maybe make on the evidence point is, seems to me we're moving down a path of different sources of evidence than the auditor may be used to obtaining, and not that it's completely new sources of evidence that we've never seen before, but it's a shift in the type of audit evidence, which to me gets at some of the discussion we're just having on are there things the PCAOB could think about doing from the perspective of evaluating audit evidence, considering that we're thinking about a shift in the nature of the type of evidence.
Thanks, Brian. Next, Arch.
Thanks, Tony. Touch on a few things here, and Brian actually just brought up something that I was going to bring up as well, and that is from the standpoint of the preparer. And clearly, when I see the new standards coming out, the preparers are going to have an appropriate process in place to reach the right conclusions themselves, and that comes under the concepts of the internal controls over financial reporting. And to what extent they may need additional guidance in terms of the types of things that they have to have in place in order to record a transaction, I think they're going to need some help there as well. And I'm not quite sure where that help is going to come from. I'm sure the audit firms will provide assistance, but it should be beyond just audit firms, because we all have a common goal. I want to go back to something that Lynn said, and a few others have touched on, and that's the staffing model. I didn't hear anything that Mike said that indicated that a one-year staff person was going to go out and be dealing with somebody on a significant judgment. I don't think any of us would accept that. We never have in the past. What I see in this area, if you want to bring it under the heading of the staffing, is that I think because of the changes in the accounting, it's going to bring in a significant amount of additional consultation requirements that are going to be taking place within the firms, so that we do bring the expertise in areas of these significant judgments. That's happened in the past. I see it happening more going forward with the changes in these. When you look at the revenue rules, and the judgments that are going to be called for there, when you look at the difficulty of how do you apply a change in control to a service contract and things like that, I see the consultation process increasing. I really like Neri's analogy to the closing down the roads. I think, and Barbara spoke about a range of acceptability and the difficulty there, and the only way to solve that is to go back to such rigid rules that there's only one right answer for every single thing. And clearly the FASB, in listening to investors, that's not the direction that investors want. So we are left with things where there's going to be ranges of acceptability, and the challenges are going to come as a result of that. There's a very key sentence, I think, in the paper It's actually a quote from the FASB, and it says, "Preparers and auditors would need to apply professional judgment in more circumstances. While the SEC, investors, creditors, and other users of financial information must accept the consequences of applying professional judgments, including some divergence in practice." So precision, in my view, precision of financial statements is going down, but the information may be more relevant to investors. If I could, and hopefully everybody's in a good mood here, because I think there should be a word added to that sentence, and that word is inspectors should accept the consequences of applying professional judgments. So back to what was just discussed a minute ago, I think it's imperative that the board works with the firms to understand what's expected, because without that, it seems to me we're going to continue to have all sorts of issues coming up and issues being reported, and I think the confidence of the investors would decline if that continues to happen. So I think we need to have an understanding. We need to have an understanding of what is expected. How are we going to come to a common ground on the types of evidence that everyone is expecting to get in connection with some very difficult judgments?
Thanks, Arch. A couple, just a follow-up points. You asked about where the source of guidance is going to come. One of the things that I've observed in looking at some of these proposals and the comment letters is firms themselves have started to come out with, for example, I think Wayne was talking about the revenue standard. Firms have come out with indicators and criteria that go beyond what the FASB standard itself requires, to helping issuers saying, well, here are some things that we think are relevant in the context of estimating selling prices, in the context of software and specified upgrades. So, again, that seems to be one source that's filling the void. The other observation on you've made on the inspections, one of the things that I've observed, and is going back to when I was on the SEC staff, is when this whole move towards principles-based standards occurred, one of the things that was said was that regulators need to be, and I think it says in the FASB paper, more tolerant of judgment. And I think that may be we may not be there today, but it may be a process as we evolve towards principles-based standards. Thanks for your comments. Kevin Riley?
Couple quick points. The FASB and the IASB are trying to converge accounting standards, and therefore it is critical that we converge auditing standards. And so I implore you, if we're going to go down the track of setting new auditing standards, that you all work hand in hand with the ASB and the IAASB in making sure that we've got the same type of standards applicable to how an auditor might go through the exercise of analyzing revenue recognition. At the same time, Marty, you reviewed the agenda for standard setting yesterday. It is chock-a-block full of stuff, and therefore I think by sharing the pain with the ASB and the IAASB in terms of trying to move the ball forward, I think that would be very helpful from a resource perspective, at least from my vantage point. I think, Marty, your question on the staffing issue is an excellent one. And I think particularly if we're going to march towards a big bang where companies are going to put all this stuff into effect at one point in time, it will have to change how we've got some of our engagement staffed up. So I think we all need to be particularly vigilant about that. And I suspect from a standard setting perspective, it's hard to kind of fit that in to a box other than in the quality control standard. Last on the issue list is, and I think you've heard, on the judgment framework, that from an auditor's perspective, we think that's important. Dan, I do understand your scratching of the head on what's all that mean. So the only suggestion I could make is, would it make sense for the firms to put our heads together and try to put together a white paper, come back to you at some future point in time with some thoughts and ideas about what we mean relative to a judgment framework, if they think that would be productive?
I certainly don't see any downside in the firms putting together a paper that would express that view, so we could understand where you're coming from on that. Thanks, Kevin.
Arnold Schulder.
Thanks. This, of course, is a fascinating discussion. It makes the trip from Europe to here more than worthwhile. That is a very serious comment. That it also, of course, reminds me a lot of the discussions that we had, in particular about ISA 540, about accounting estimates, and document that I mentioned yesterday, the practice statement 1000 about auditing complex financial instruments, and just has been published yesterday as an exposure draft. So my answer to the question you have there, and I think the answer from many is a yes, you need revised standards, not or additional guidance, but and. That's precisely the lesson that we have drawn. And listening to Kevin about sharing the pain, well, actually, that's what we have done. In the case of IAPS 1000, we had an excellent cooperation between IWASB and PCAOB, as mentioned yesterday. So maybe that's at least a good example that it's not only on revising standards, but also additional educational guidance. And also listening to Jim Cox yesterday, for universities, this is a typical document that could be of use there. So I would agree that, on one hand, judgments have been in the profession from the very beginning, but on the other hand, I would even more agree to those that have said there is a, what I think Brian called, a shift in the nature and the type of evidence and of judgments. It's becoming more over the place, it's more and more qualitative, and it's also more and more challenging management. And that's precisely what I see in the language in ISA 540, evaluating, for example, how management has considered alternative assumptions or outcomes and why it has rejected them, a lot about the documentation that you need for that, accounting documentation as it is. So we are in that reality that auditors have to challenge more and more assumptions and outcomes that management has made. So that's my first point. We have now this reality, and let's make optimal use of what we have jointly produced, in a way. The other point is that there's a very important link to other discussions from yesterday. There is a link to the quality control culture, and there's a number of, as I said, standing up. Well, indeed, but that's what you have to learn people how to do that, and you have to promote it. So there is a link to that issue as well. There is a link to audit committees. You also find that in ISA 540, those charged with governance, because certainly the important assumptions, they have to be involved as well. So there's another place to bring it together. Audit reports, of course, education and training, and I agree with Arts, also inspectors. So the conclusion is it's not an issue that you can handle on its own. You have to, on one hand, but it also needs to be taken into account in that much wider context, and that's why I think it's so fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Jim Cox.
I wanted to just comment on a couple of observations or analogies were made here. I think Barbara Roper nailed it when she talks about the dilemma, or really is more of a Hobson's choice when moved from principles from rules to principles accounting, and take us back to discussions we had, and we've had discussion drafts on this. But at the roundtable on the 21st, we talked about auditors' communications and how that would provide an important supplement and useful information, which I think goes partway to trying to give a better view about what the understanding is of financial statements prepared under principles rather than rules. And maybe make that information somewhat more comparable. But the problem is, as Charlie points out with that, is that we tend to think that the disclosure's out there to catch the wild pitch, which I think is a good analogy. Because what happens sometimes with these collateral disclosures is they become like milquetoast or boilerplate, and they conceal much more than they really reveal. And I've thought about how to address that concern in the same standpoint of trying to enhance the communications from the auditors to the investor communities, or more particularly, maybe even to the audit committee. And that's to think that maybe there ought to be a judgment at the end of the day that's made by the auditor, an evaluation, which becomes part of that communication. And, you know, we can quibble about where that communication has to go, whether it's going to be out there on the website or whether it's just to the audit committee or perhaps even just to a regulator. I think it ought to be to the audit committee at least. But that communication could be a judgment in maybe five different categories about the combination of the assessments and the judgments and the assumptions that went into it. I mean, one would be aggressive, one would be optimistic, one would be reasonable, one would be pessimistic, and perhaps the fifth one would be the unpardonable. But it would be some evaluation there, which all auditors would be. And that would be going back to Barbara's point, that one of our fears when you move toward principles-based accounting, and this has been out there for a long time in literature, is sort of the tail end of the curve. I mean, these 3-5%, whatever it is going to be out there, there's going to be not because they're necessarily malicious, but just that they're overly aggressive. And knowing that in the investor community, I've got to think, would be extremely helpful in understanding what these financial statements actually mean.
Okay, thanks. Jim, you had touched on disclosures, and a number of people have mentioned disclosures. That is included in our second topic, but it relates naturally to what we're discussing, and so to the extent people have comments on disclosures, we can entertain those as well. One of the things that I think has been constituents have told us in terms of audit challenges, and we put this in the briefing paper, is disclosure is you know, pardon the term, the ugly stepsister to recognition and measurement often. And what often happens is, in terms of issuers dealing with regulators, it's far more likely that a regulator will say, in the next filing, please disclose X. And it's very unlikely, it's rare that they have the same view for recognition and measurement. So, you know, one of the things that we put in the briefing paper is, when does a disclosure, when does a disagreement between auditors and issuers rise to the level of a disclosure difference? So, but that touched upon, Jim, some of the comments you made about disclosures. Next, Doug Anderson.
Thanks. There's a lot of things I agree with in the discussions going, but I just wanted to touch on two points. One is, I really think there's a place for the PCAOB to get ahead of some of the issues here, but I caution to worry about always writing a rule book in a standard of exactly how to do it. In fact, that's one of my issues with the confirmation standard. I think it's a little bit too prescriptive and doesn't rely a lot on the judgment of the auditor. But I think there's a real space here with each of these standards, accounting standards, to look at other guidance that could be provided, whether it's the Q&A document or a practice alert, to really go through and say, based on the knowledge of inspections that the PCAOB has gathered over the years, what are going to be the problems that auditors will have implementing this new accounting standard, and try to get ahead of that with some of this other supplemental guidance. I think there's a strong need for that, but I would caution trying to worry about writing a very prescriptive auditing rule book-based standard for all of these as you move forward, which my example is going to be disclosures. I guess you queued that up, Tony. I was going to say, we have some guidance, I think a standard out there now on materiality, and I think that fills a need. As I think about it, I can't think much about disclosure. And I think there's really a good opportunity to, and this could be a nice standard, it could be other guidance, talking about the auditor's responsibility with disclosures and giving more context around that and giving more strength around how to view the adequacy or inadequacy disclosures. I think there are things that could be written there that could be strengthening it, and I do think that's a gap. The other thing I want to mention is the whole question of documentation, and I've always been a very strong proponent of documentation over my many years of doing things. And while I think the PCAOB needs to reconsider what is in the current standards and auditor documentation as the need for judgment increases in accounting, that'll probably raise the level of judgment in auditing, so I think that's a good thing to do. But I wanted to, I guess, have a caution on a comment that I heard stated here, where that the auditing standards need to pick up where the accounting rules leave off, because I think there's a gap between those. And I would not like to see repeat what we saw when SOX 404 first came out, where effectively the rules for issuers were written by the auditing standards and the firm's interpretation of those auditing standards. And it wasn't until later that the SEC came out with the guidance to issuers of how to comply with having good ICFR in 404. And so I would think there is a place for rules, guidance, whatever you call it, to the issuers directly from the SEC if complying with the new accounting standards makes complying with Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley difficult in the form of documentation. Let's get that guidance out from the SEC directly to the issuers. That's the right body to do it, I would think. Not indirectly from the PCAOB to the auditing firms to the issuers. We've done that before. It's dysfunctional, and I wouldn't suggest doing it again.
Okay, thanks, Doug. On your comment on increasing auditor documentation, I think AS3 does include some guidance on, and to the extent there's an increased judgment, there's a requirement for increased documentation. Next is Sam Ranzillo.
Thanks, Tony. When you know Lynn Turner leaves before I get to speak.
I don't think there was a connection.
Yeah. let me express my auditor skepticism first. I think Neary said everybody is right, so by definition, everybody is wrong. And I think as it relates to, there's a couple points I want to bring up, let me pick up on Doug's first, because I think I heard somebody say that the auditors ought to be determining the documentation requirements for management, and I guess I caution this board that was one of the major flaws with the adoption of 404 and one of the major flaws with auditing standard number 2, and I would hope that we would learn from that experience. I also like to pick up on Arch's point, which I think is embedded in this, and I'm going to violate one of my basic principles, which is to use the words principle-based standards and rules-based standards, because quite frankly, there is no such thing as either one of those two. All standards are a combination of both, and I know it's convenient to talk about one versus the other because you feel much more comfortable going to the extreme when you use rules versus principle-based standards to make a point, and I think sometimes those points are invalid. But to Arch's point, and I think the thing that is probably bothering people and is an undercurrent to, I'm gonna use principle-based standards, but is an undercurrent is that what both boards are trying to do is to get to more relevant information. And whether let's just accept for the moment that fair value is more relevant than historical cost. I honestly don't believe that for every financial instrument, but I'll use it to make a point. In that fair value is more relevant, but unequivocally, it has more measurement uncertainty associated with it. And I think what people are, when they talk about principle-based standards, I think that's sort of the undercurrent is I'm a little uncomfortable moving away from things that are more certain but less relevant. You can say the same thing with respect to revenue recognition. What is most certain is if I buy a sweater, that whoever I buy it from doesn't record the revenue until I throw it away because now I have no right of return left because I threw that sweater away. That is revenue. I don't think anybody would doubt that. Might be 6 years after I bought the doggone thing, but is that very relevant information? And I think the boards are trying to create more relevant information, get information up onto balance sheets earlier than what we have. Revenue, I think, is a good example. I think they're on the right path, but there's going to be some more measurement uncertainty associated with that. When you book a revenue transaction under the new standard, you may not be finished with booking revenue on that transaction. There might be two or three more reporting periods that are affected by that. I think that makes some people uncomfortable, and that and they're using principle-based standards as sort of the handle to express that. Quite frankly, I think you need to get over it. And there are going to be changes to things that we historically haven't seen changes to. You know, you book revenue and you go back in now and adjust revenue, it's pretty much a restatement. Changes to revenue now are going to become more of a common exercise as we try to better reflect what happened at the point in time. On the judgment framework, I'm probably a little bit different here than my peers in the other firms. I think you cannot have an auditing framework without starting with an accounting framework. So when I, you know, when I looked at the Treasury recommendations, I always, just conceptually, and I've been wrong and probably a half a dozen times since I started speaking, I've been wrong, but I always viewed that as an accounting framework. And I think until you build the accounting judgment framework, which I am a proponent for, I think it's hard to write one, although it looks like Kevin Riley's gonna head us down that path. But and I'm sure I'll be participating.
I was going to turn that over to you.
Yeah, I figured. Well, I said I'm sure I'll be participating. But I do think you've got to start with the accounting and then build off of it. And to the last point, and then I'll shut up. I do, again, using principle-based versus rules-based, but I think a very dangerous cocktail is principle-based accounting standards and rules-based auditing standards. And I, too, have seen some movement in the board towards more prescriptive standards. And I appreciate there's thoughts behind that, but I think writing prescriptive standards where the accounting standards are providing for more judgment, I think that's a really dangerous cocktail, and one that, you know, we'll work our way through it, but I think it'll cause more pain than it's worth. Thanks.
Thanks, Sam. I just wanted to thanks for all those comments, but on the documentation, I didn't hear, maybe you did, but I didn't hear at least anybody from our organization saying that we should go down the path of setting standards for preparer documentation. But I think I did hear that there certainly are a lot of requirements for auditor documentation, and maybe there aren't as many requirements for preparer documentation. And it sounded like a number of people were saying it would be more helpful, especially as these standards are written, which clearly have more, whether you use principles based or what, have more judgments, more estimates, so more judgments based. Requirements for preparer documentation sound like an important aspect of it.
Marty, I don't think it was somebody on the current staff that made that comment. I also don't think that it's FASB's job to set what the documentation requirements should be by preparers. I mean, I think that's not the role of an accounting standard setter, but I don't remember. I think it came from that side of the table that said, well, wait a minute, there's processes that have to be developed. There's internal controls, there's disclosure controls, and procedures that entities have to have in order to sign certifications. That all gets embedded in how do you document your judgments. And I don't think it's like we haven't done that already. It's just I think there's going to be a few more in each of the areas, like revenue, where today you don't have to determine upfront contingent consideration. Your policy is we don't book it till it gets into our bank account. Well, that doesn't leave a lot of judgment. That's not real hard to implement. But now where you're going to have variable consideration, then you're going to have to build processes. And I think somebody made the point that the accounting firms, I think Tony did, and I thought it was an excellent point, that accounting firms are writing guidance. And, you know, as we've looked at how do we guide our people or our clients, how you write guidance, accounting guidance, as a national office is very different with standards that are very prescriptive versus ones that provide more judgment. You have to provide a different form of guidance. I mean, it's not you just roll it out there and say, you know, here's some meat, go get it. But you write things in the form of consideration, sort of questions, things you ought to be considering. I think the board has done the same thing in the writing of the accounting standard. So I didn't mean to imply that I heard one of the staff on that you ought to be setting management's standards for documentation.
Thanks, Sam. Tom Linsmeyer.